on The Book Show with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Well, technically speaking, February only has 4 Sundays, but if we had 30 days in February this year, as more than just our 29 that we did have, this would be the last February of American History Month. So we're going to fudge a little bit and welcome a scholar to talk to us about the Christian foundation of America. It's Mark David Hall, whose new book is Did America Have a Christian Founding? It's from Thomas Nelson. The book endeavors to separate modern myth from historical truth. Mark is the Herbert Hoover Distinguished Professor of Politics and Faculty Fellow in the William Penn Honors Program at George Fox University. He is also Associated Faculty at the Center for the Study of Law and Religion at Emory University and Senior Fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion. He has written, edited, or co-edited a dozen books on religion and politics in America and is a nationally recognized expert on religious freedom. We're delighted to welcome him today to On the Bookshelf. Mark, so glad to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
There are several things that have come to be almost accepted, and certainly by the people who write textbooks, that America was not really founded by people who were really Christians, but mostly deists, and they used euphemisms to talk about God because they didn't really believe in him. There was that whole wall of separation thing in the letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote, and so on and so forth. Really, what you're doing in this book is saying, let's take a close look at all of these suppositions that have become accepted as dogma by modern historians, but were not seen that way up until about, I don't know, maybe the post-World War II era.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And your characterization of the literature is spot on. Book after book makes claims like most of America's founders were deists, they created a godless constitution, they built a wall of separation between church and state. I mean, you know, prominent scholars, popular authors, and unfortunately, too many textbooks. I went through every high school and college history textbook I could find a few years ago, and you see these claims in book after book after book. And so my book, Did America Have a Christian Founding? Attempts to set the record straight.
So what you did was take a look at what these people actually wrote, and you also delineated between people who were founding fathers, some of whom there were, as it turns out, were deists, though not nearly as many and not nearly as prominent among the founding fathers as these modern historians would say. And this gives us an idea of what these people really did and how much influence they really had, which that was one of the things I found the most interesting, that some of the writings that are often touted as being foundational things turned out not necessarily have been that influential at all.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So my first substantive chapter asked the question, were any of America's founders deists? And one of the things I do that, of course, any reader should be on the lookout is I actually define my terms. What do I mean by deist? And if we accept a common definition of deist, of deism as being a theological system where a God exists, creates the earth, and then pulls away from it, so God does not intervene in the affairs of men and nations, if we use that as their definition of deism, then I think there's only one or two clear deists, Ethan Allen and Thomas Paine. Now, we know for sure that a Thomas Jefferson and a Ben Franklin and a John Adams are not Orthodox Christians, but that's not the same thing as being a deist. And in fact, they routinely speak about God intervening in human affairs, particularly Franklin and Adams. They do it all the time. And so as deism is usually defined, there's precious little evidence that more than a handful of founders were deists. And we turn from these elite and interesting founders to your more run-of-the-mill founders, still important people, right? They participated in the first federal Congress, in their state legislatures, in the ratification conventions. When you look at this broader constellation of founders, the evidence of deism virtually disappears. There's really precious few deists running around in late 18th century America.
I think that's a critical distinction, that deism has sometimes been described as the creator of the universe wound up the universe and then left it to run itself. Yet Benjamin Franklin, who is often considered by modern scholars to be a deist, doesn't seem that way when you take a look at the things that he wrote, the people that he admired, such as Methodist preacher George Whitefield, and things that he was quoted as saying in several occasions, including at the Constitutional Convention.
No, that's exactly right. He, in his autobiography, which wasn't published until after his death. He did say that as a young man, I came under the influence of the deist. But then he says, he goes on to say, but I recognized right away this was a very dangerous doctrine, and I kept my thoughts private. But one thing we should recognize about Franklin, and I'm sure we all know people like this, and you already suggested maybe he took the leap of faith, he evolved throughout his lifetime. And the beginning of the quote that you mentioned, it actually begins, "The longer I live, the more that I see that God intervenes in the affairs of men and nations," or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And Franklin was the oldest man at the Federal Convention. His proposal that the delegates open in prayer was immediately seconded by Roger Sherman of Connecticut, second oldest man. And so I think there's very good reasons to believe that Franklin was evolving, that he definitely came to understand that God exists and that God intervenes in human affairs, that God does miracles. And he pointed specifically to miracles that he thought God did. Whether or not he accepted Jesus Christ as his Lord and Savior, we just don't know, but right. It certainly is a possibility.
Now, Thomas Paine, on the other hand, I just finished a new biography of him a couple of weeks ago. Apparently, the older he got, the further he moved away from kind of orthodox. He had an Anglican mother and a Quaker father. And the older he got and the further away, the more he was influenced as one of the supporters early on in the French Revolution and so forth. The further mm-hmm. he moved, the more he moved away from any sort of orthodoxy and strictly into deism and maybe even into agnosticism by the time he died. And because of that, he was roundly dismissed and ignored later in his life when he tried to come back to America after the French Revolution. Even Washington wrote about how he was disappointed in Thomas Paine's lack of appreciation for the hand of Providence. Just because people don't necessarily do the same kind of things doesn't mean that they're not believers in God.
Certainly the case. Yeah, Paine is an interesting character. You're exactly right. You wrote this three-volume Age of Reason, clearly a deistic work. But Paine only spent about 22 of his 70-some years in America. He was born and raised in England. He came over here, and then almost, not right away, but after a few years, he went back to Europe. And when at the very end of his life, he came back to America, almost literally no one wanted to have anything to do with him. When he finally died, not even the liberal, tolerant Quakers would let him be buried in their churchyard. So he had to be buried on a farm. George Washington is a great example of someone that everyone calls a deist, and yet he references Providence something like over 500 times. He is always talking about how God intervenes in his personal life and the life of the nation. He routinely is talking about it, and this is certainly not something that deists do. Now, you're exactly right that he didn't take communion, but that might have been because he had such a very high view of it. And I think we need to be very careful reading into an act like that, that he was somehow not an Orthodox Christian.
And we're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Mark David Hall, who's the author of Did America Have a Christian Founding? It's from Nelson Books. It is an outgrowth of a lecture that Mark gave at the Heritage Foundation in 2010 entitled Did America Have a Christian Founding? C-SPAN televised it. An essay based on it has been downloaded from more than 300,000 times, and the book expands on that. And the second part of the book and the second premise is that the people who are often given a great amount of credit for influencing the Constitution were not necessarily nearly as influential on the Constitution and particularly on the First Amendment as these latter-day historians would say.
Yeah, no, that's a very important distinction. I think we have to look carefully. Whenever we're looking at a text that is a product of a community, whatever that community is, we need to look at the entire community. So take something like the Bill of Rights, just for example, the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Jurist after jurist and author after author has said that we must read this amendment in light of the views of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. But this is just utter nonsense. Jefferson had nothing to do with writing the amendment. He wasn't in America at the time. He wasn't in America when most of the states ratified the amendment. There's no record that people were looking to his writings as some sort of guidance. So it's just nonsense to include his views in understanding, if we were interested in the original understanding of the First Amendment, to look at his views. Now, James Madison was involved, and James Madison wanted a greater degree of separation between church and state than many founders, But when you turn from Madison and look at the rest of the founders that were involved in the first federal Congress, people like Roger Sherman, Elias Boudinot, Charles Carroll, Abraham Baldwin, people who played very important roles in crafting the First Amendment, we don't see anything like a desire to strictly separate church and state. And so if we really are interested in what the founders intended the First Amendment to do, we have to include Madison in that discussion, but we need to include the others as well. And what we see is there's just no evidence whatsoever. There's no good historical argument that the founders wanted to separate church and state.
One of the things that you point out is they're often given way too much credit. Jefferson had nothing to do with the Constitution, really. He was in France at the time as an ambassador, although he wrote most of the Declaration of Independence. He didn't have anything to do with the Constitution particularly. Madison is admittedly kind of a disciple, if you will, of Jefferson, but they didn't agree about everything. And Madison had a lot of influence, of course, on the Constitution, but not nearly as much on the Bill of Rights. So the point you're making in Chapter 3 is that we shouldn't read into the understanding of the Constitution modern sensitivities, that the correct way to interpret the Constitution is in its context and in the light of the people, what their intentions were. And it's pretty obvious that the people who wrote the Constitution, just like the people who signed the Declaration, may or may not have been Orthodox Christians, but the nation was overwhelmingly Protestant at that time.
So, if we just shift over the Constitution for a minute, you're correct that Madison was in the Constitutional Convention. He was an important player there. But if you look at the Virginia Plan, which he started off with, he proposed a national government that would really have unlimited power. Whatever the national government thought it needed to do, it could do. Someone like Roger Sherman said, that is insane. That's crazy. That's way too dangerous. He agreed with Lord Acton that power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so he insisted that the power of the national government be limited through Article 1, Section 8, which sort of lists what the national government can do with implication that it can't do anything else. And as well, he insisted on things like separation of powers, checks and balances. And thank goodness he did. Our constitutional order isn't perfect, and there's been some shifts over the last 60 years that I think are profoundly worrisome. But this Constitution has served America very well, and I think in large part because the founders were profoundly influenced by Christian ideas. I just mentioned one, the sinfulness of humans. But there are plenty of others. The fact that we're creating the Imago Dei, their understanding of liberty was one that was constrained by the moral law, and on we could go.
Let's talk about Washington again. Certainly one of the most important founding fathers who talked to great extent about providence and the importance of God watching over us and guiding us, and proclaimed national days of thanksgiving and led prayers with the Continental Army. This is certainly not a guy who just thinks that God wound it up and let it go. Quoting him here, and this is a quote that you have, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." Many of the founding fathers, they all said that the only thing that's going to allow a democratic republic to work is if we have a moral people, and the only way to make sure that they're moral is to base our laws and our way of doing things on the morality of the Bible.
Yeah, no, that's correct. Jim Hudson of the Library of Congress calls this a founder syllogism, like a logical argument, that you must have a moral people if you're to have a Republican form of government, and if the people are to be moral, they must be religious. And although today we could use the word religious and mean, you know, abroad, any sort of religion, for the America's founders, it clearly, if you look at the use in context, it clearly is referring to Christianity. And so I think our founders would be pretty worried if they were to come to 21st century America and find, you know, maybe 70% of us claim to be Christians of one stripe or the other, but then, of course, many of these people claiming to be followers of Christ can't be bothered to go to church or to pray or to read their Bible. Yeah, the founders would be very worried by this, were they to return and see us today.
You in the book, you talked about that one of the documents that's often quoted as being very influential on that the Virginia Statute. Oftentimes, modern historians say that the Virginia Statute was absolutely influential on the First Amendment, and that it was the founding document of the founding document kind of approach, and therefore the United States understood that they weren't going to encourage religion at all, but that's not what your research discovered, was it? That it wasn't nearly as a foundational document as modern historians claim that it is.
Yeah, thank you for calling attention to that. It actually was a academic article I published where I think I came as close as you can come to proving a negative. One of the things I do in the article is I begin with like 19 quotes from prominent scholars and jurists saying that the authors of the First Amendment were inspired by the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, which of course was enacted in 1786, that the First Amendment put together in 1789. And so I asked the question, what evidence is there of this? And I combed through every debate I could find, legislative proceedings, newspapers, and there's just simply no evidence to support this. People aren't talking about it. People aren't quoting it. People aren't pointing it to it as an example in the 18th century. On the other hand, something like Massachusetts's Article 3, which has to do with religious establishments, was literally quoted in like three other state constitutions, and it was referred to, and the Virginia Article 16 of the Virginia Declaration of Rights was referenced throughout the nation as well. So you can point to some documents that seem to have some influence, but the Virginia statute is not among them. The reason I think scholars say this, and some justices, is because they want to read the First Amendment simply and solely in light of this Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, James Madison's Memorial and Remonstrance, written in the same context, but then particularly Thomas Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptist, where he talks about the First Amendment creating a wall of separation between church and state. But that doesn't come about to the 19th century. And then finally, you have this obscure manuscript that Madison penned and never published in his lifetime called the Detached Memorandum. And in this detached memorandum, even though it's president, he issued four presidential calls for prayer. In this detached memorandum, he said, well, maybe I shouldn't have done that. And he also questioned the wisdom of legislative chaplains, even though when he was a member of Congress, he voted for legislative chaplains and to pay legislative chaplains. And so it's just the worst sort of law office history. People who want the separation of church and state, they go back into the era, find the very, very few documents that seem to suggest that some of the founders wanted this strict separation of church and state, and they quote them and pretend they have an influence that they simply do not.
My understanding is that the letter that Jefferson wrote, and the reason that he was the recipient of a giant wheel of cheese sent to him by the Baptist of Virginia, was that he was addressing a situation in Virginia where there was tax support for Anglican clergy. And the Baptists were saying, it's not fair for us to have to pay for somebody else's pastor. We have to pay for our own pastor. Why should we have to pay the state church, so to speak, of the state of Virginia? And Jefferson apparently wrote and said, I agree with you. You know, it's not fair for you to do that, and that shouldn't be. That is not the same as saying there should be no churches in Virginia, which is kind of the way you feel that certain historians or scholars would like it to mean. It just means he didn't think tax money ought to go for one denomination of Christianity over another.
Yeah, no, that's right. The Jefferson's letter is to the Danbury Baptists, which are up in Connecticut. And you're right, they were basically complaining about the Connecticut establishment. Jefferson wrote to them. But here's something that's very telling. I tell a couple of stories like this. Literally the day after, and I'm not kidding, literally the day after Jefferson penned this letter to the Danbury Baptist saying that the First Amendment creates a wall of separation between church and state, he goes to church services in the U.S. Capitol building, where he hears John Leland, the great Baptist itinerant minister and himself an opponent of religious establishments, preach. And that just highlights the distinction that you just mentioned. It's one thing to say the government shouldn't be taxing people to support a favored church. It's another thing altogether to say that there has to be a strict separation of church and state. And it seems to me, and I argue this in one of the chapters, that even Jefferson, even though he pens a few documents that make it sound like church and state must be very separated, in his own life, in his own public life, in his actions as president, He did not act as if there was a wall of separation between church and state. He wanted a greater degree of separation between church and state than other Americans, almost any other American. But still, he passed along to the Senate a treaty with the Kaskaskia Indians that provided money to build a church for them, to hire a Roman Catholic priest for them. He suggested that the national seal should be an image of Moses leading the people of Israel to freedom and the Red Sea collapsing in among the Pharaoh's army. And I could keep going, example after example. Even Jefferson did not want this strict separation of church and state. Yes, he opposed tax dollars going to churches, but I think for very good reason. I would oppose that today if Oregon decided it wanted to start taxing people to support a favored church, mm-hmm. or even all churches. I would oppose it as a horrible idea. Whenever you get the government involved in the affairs of the church, it ends up hurting the church.
Yeah, look how well it worked in Europe.
Exactly.
This brings us to the present then, and I realize our time's getting short, but in the chapter Christianity and Religious Liberty and Redemption, you talk about the way that things have gone completely in the opposite direction, that now it seems that the interpretation is that the government has nothing to do with religion, should never encourage anybody to be religious, and if you are religious, they're within their rights to punish you for it or fire you for it, and that the religious liberty really is under attack now if it has the temerity to disagree with anything that the cultural understanding happens to be about morality. If we're not tolerant, then we're wrong, and it's okay to sue us and put us out of business and so forth. And you use the example of Baronel Stutzman, who's a Richland, Washington florist.
Yeah, no, this is exactly right. So if you go back to 1993, Congress passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act by a vote of 97-3 in the Senate, unanimously in the House. It was signed into law by President Bill Clinton. And I just pointed out to suggest that back in the 90s, liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans could come together to protect religious liberty. Over the last decade, the left has pretty much abandoned religious liberty. They might stick up for the ability of a Native American to use peyote in a religious ceremony, but you're exactly right. When it comes to a 65-year-old grandmother who feels she can't participate in a same-sex wedding ceremony, they say, too bad for you, Granny. We're going to drive you out of business. When it comes to a baker who lovingly serves all of his customers, including same-sex attractive customers, but when he says, I'm sorry, I can't create a custom cake for your wedding, too bad for you, Mr. Baker. Out of business you go. It just really is overreach on the political left. This is almost all coming from. And so one of the things I argue in the book is America's founders embraced a very robust understanding of religious liberty, an understanding of religious liberty that protects everyone. It does protect your Native American who needs to use peyote in a religious ceremony, but it certainly protects Protestants and Christians and Jews and Muslims who want to act upon the religious convictions today. And so, yeah, people like Baronel Stutzman, Jack Phillips should absolutely be protected by the First Amendment or by various state statutes and religious liberty provisions there. And it's just amazing how little they have actually been protected. There have been some important victories, but so many times these professionals lose their cases in the state courts anyway.
What can Americans who are Christian do to stand up for the Founding Fathers' ideas and ideals?
You know, that's a great question. I think we should advocate for religious liberty, and I would emphasize that we should advocate for the religious liberty of everyone. So if there's a group of Jews in a small Alabama town and they're trying to get a synagogue constructed and the town's discriminating against them, I think Christians should be the first to say no. Let them create their synagogue. Let them create their house of worship. I think we should take this into account when we vote. We should be asking our elected leaders, how are you voting? How are you, what are you doing to protect religious liberty? I mentioned a few of the legal advocacy groups that are doing so much good work. First Liberty, Alliance Defending Freedom, the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. These folks are on the front lines every day battling for religious liberty. And I know most of us are strapped just supporting our local church and charities, but if some of us have a few extra dollars left over, I think these organizations are more than worthy of our support.
Mark, anything else that you want to mention before we go?
You know, the one thing I would mention, you mentioned at the very beginning that I've authored or edited a dozen academic books. I would want to emphasize that this book is aimed at the general reading public, so anyone with an interest in these should find it very accessible and easy but hopefully informative read.
Absolutely. Our guest today has been Mark David Hall, the author of Did America Have a Christian Founding? Separating Modern Myth from Historical Truth, from Nelson Books, an imprint of Thomas Nelson. It's available online and bookstores everywhere. Mark, thank you very much. A very interesting and informative book. You lay things out in such a way that you don't have to be an official scholar to make sense of it, and I appreciate that very much. Do you have a website?
Yeah, my wife built me a nice little website, markdavidhall.org.
And thank you so much for taking time to be with us here on the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Once again, Mark David Hall, our guest today. Did America Have a Christian Founding? Separating Modern Myth from Historical Truth. It's from Nelson Books, an imprint of Thomas Nelson, and his website is markdavidhall.org. Thanks so much for joining us on the Bookshelf. Next week, we'll start looking at Women's History Month on the Bookshelf and hope to have some very special programs for you. So stay tuned every week and also check out the radio station website, WTBFradio.com, where we have archived On the Bookshelf shows. And coming soon, maybe by the time this airs, my wife is putting together a podcast for me, which will feature the interviews. And so I hope you look forward to that. And when we get that set up, I'll give you the location to find those as well. Until then, we'll see you next week right here on your favorite radio stations. I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.